I'm just waiting.
All right. So good morning, live streamers. You got me all to yourself this morning, and I hear you had questions, and I just want to be here for you. I hope you've been enjoying this. We've been really excited to have you here, and the interaction has been awesome. I kind of took a look on the Facebook group last night, and you guys have been active and posting, and it's been just lovely. So hopefully by now you have questions, you have comments, you have things you want to share, maybe questions about the content so far, questions about the program, because it's an exciting program, and I'm really thrilled to be able to offer it to you guys as well as to the people here in the audience. So how about it, Nilin?
Okay, my webcast went down, so.
Oh. Okay, so I'll just keep talking. Hello, guys. While we wait.
I have it here.
Okay.
Do you have a question?
Good morning. Good morning, Vietnam. That's awesome. Thanks for that.
Lynn's waiting to get her live stream back, so we're looking to see what your questions are. But I will just talk until I have questions, because I know that
there's a delay. Why didn't you talk about some of the things you were talking about last night?
Oh, my. We had such an awesome Q&A last night.
Do you still have that oil, the fat thing?
I got a question from Ellen Bell.
Ellen Bell, great.
Mike.
Okay, we have a question here from Ellen Bell. It says, good morning. I have a client with Hashimoto's. She's asking for a food intolerance test. Do you ever recommend one?
That's a great question. And generally, people with Hashimoto's have food intolerances. It just goes with the course, leaky gut, food intolerances, possible heavy metals, toxic overload. So yeah, food intolerance test. Either I do an elimination provocation, which I believe is the gold standard. It's the way to fully, truly assess for food intolerances. However, some people just don't have the patience to do it because it takes time to eliminate the foods and then add them back. So with somebody with Hashimoto's, the first thing I would do is eliminate the top six allergens, which we'll go over today during class. Gluten, dairy, corn, soy, eggs, peanuts, and gluten, dairy, corn, soy, eggs, and peanuts. That's six plus sugar plus processed foods, processed fats. That's a great starting point for anyone with Hashimoto's. The other thing you want to make sure you do is balance their blood sugar. So I know that's not answering your question yet, but you've got to do all those things. As far as the food intolerance, generally I use Alcat if I'm going to do a food intolerance, because it tests more than, it's usually a food intolerance versus just food allergy. And when you do some of the other tests, they're doing an IgG, IgA, IgE. They usually do just one subset. As Tom O'Brien said yesterday, they just do one branch of the armed forces and they don't check for the other branches. The ALCAT tests like a global systemic inflammatory response. Is it 100%? No way. Are any of them 100%? No way. Some not even close. But it gives you an idea of, at the moment, what is the person responding to. Unfortunately, with people, especially with Hashimoto's, they've got a leaky gut, and they're responding and reacting to lots of stuff. So you'll get this response back, and it says, oh my God, they're sensitive to 27 different foods, or in some cases, 82 different foods. It's a lot. So it's hard. You've got to get them off of those foods. But if you just get them off of those foods and get them eating other foods, they're going to have a whole new set of sensitivities the next time you test them. So you've got to work on the leaky gut. Remember the Tom O'Brien talked yesterday about that brush border of the intestine. You got to get it to go from Berber back to shag. And when you get it back to shag, that's when the food intolerances are going to go away. If you find a lot of food intolerances, especially with a Hashimoto's person, you're going to have to do a rotation diet. You can't let them eat the same thing over and over. You've got to make sure they're taking digestive enzymes to break that food down, so you have the minimum amount of those undigested food particles, so they're little bitty amino acids and fatty acids and carbohydrate sugars, basically. And if they're not, and they're not chewing well, and they're not doing heart math before they eat, they're going to continue to assault that gut lining even when they're off of all their trigger foods, and they'll develop new trigger foods. So that's my long answer to an easy question.
Is the ALCAT test available to non-licensed practitioners?
Yes, I believe it is. Yes, because that's that talk I had with Brian. He said, it is. Yeah, it is.
Cass wants to know how to go about including green juices plus raw foods when a client has food allergies that are related to green fruits, greens and fruits.
Okay, so generally, you know, when we look at food allergies, food intolerances, people are generally not going to be sensitive to an entire class of foods. If indeed a person is sensitive to and reacts to green foods, you've got to look at why. It's usually not a food allergy. It's usually an intolerance to a chemical constituent in there. It could be an oxalate sensitivity. It could be a sulfur sensitivity. So those are the main ones that are going to affect, and some it could be related to the goitrogens, but that's usually much more rare. Oxalate is very common. So if you see somebody that they're just, every time they drink a green juice or eat greens or eat salads or eat broccoli and stuff, they're reacting, look at oxalates. And look up oxalates, look up low oxalate diet, put them on a low oxalate diet for a while. And there's greens that are not high in those. So what I would do is be doing this elimination diet and figuring out which greens they can tolerate and then rotate the ones they can.
Okay. There's a food allergy test called LEAP, L-E-A-P. Are you familiar and any thoughts?
I haven't researched LEAP. I know about it, and one of my clients brought in a report that she had a LEAP test done. Off the top of my head, I'm not recalling what the difference in the mechanism is, but I know it's not your standard IgA, IgG, IgE kind of test, but I don't know the details of it.
What would you do if you have a client who has Hashimoto's who also has Borrelia, which may be the root?
Oh, we got to get rid of the Borrelia. We got to look at what, you know, building up their immune system. You may have to do some antimicrobial things to get that down. You've got to build up the host tolerance, basically. You've got to build up the strength and the ability of the immune system to break that down. And yes, Borrelia could be a root cause. Other kinds of infections, fungal infections, parasitic infections, and it could also be that they're reacting to toxic metals. And a lot of times these underlying bacterial or microbial infections are being fed because they also have a toxic metal overload. You've got to really look at all of that, especially with Hashimoto's. There's so many different triggers, and really you've got to address all of them and see which ones are active. And don't forget blood sugar, please, because everybody overlooks the blood sugar. They think, my client's okay, their fasting blood sugar is 82. We'll talk a little bit about that today, and then we talk way more about that in our program that's coming up in November, which is the blood sugar balancing, the insulin resistance for practitioners.
How do you test true thyroid values when they're on a thyroid replacement, and then do you have them hold the replacement for a while?
Okay, that's a good question. Generally, when you're testing someone for the thyroid, the adrenal, you want to test them at what they're doing right now. So if they are already on thyroid or adrenal support and you take them off and then you test it, you're not getting a true state. You're getting this response. You don't even know what it is because you're getting a response to something they're not doing. So you either catch them before they go on the replacement, or if they're on it, you test them on it. And that lets you know, is what they're taking appropriate for them? Are they taking enough? Are they taking too much? And then you titrate them that way. If you want to take them off, they could be feeling pretty darn miserable for a while as if their levels are dropping. So I would not take them off. I would just test them where they're at and see what their body's doing with what you're giving them. And you can tell by where the numbers are if they're on too much or too little, and then you can change it.
What protocol do you use for leaky gut, and what do you start with first as treatment options?
Well, I could spend a couple of hours talking about the whole protocol for leaky gut. I will say that the first thing is removing the offending food. So there's the list of potential allergens, common allergens, but there's a list of foods that aggravate and irritate the gut. Caffeine, alcohol, dairy products, which is also allergenic but can also aggravate the gut. There's a lot of them. Processed foods, hydrogenated fats, heated oxidized fats. There's gluten and also other allergens. Grains are very irritating. So you just get them off of those foods. That's your starting point, right? Take the gasoline off the fire, and then you want to heal the fire. And the things, some of the things I use, I'll just throw out some things, but the protocol is going to be different from person to person depending on what I'm detecting. Vitamin B1 is really good one for rebuilding those villi. They've been told to plump them up and help them to regrow. 150 milligrams three times a day, which is a large dose of B1. I oftentimes do it in the form of bentphotamine. I can never say that word, but it's the fat-soluble bentphotamine or something like that is how you say it. And then the other thing is glutamine. A lot of people can't take glutamine, though. Some people who have a GAD SNP in their genetics will convert the glutamine into glutamic acid, which is excitatory, and they cannot take that and convert it to GABA, so you give them glutamine. If you give them glutamine and they're going, I'm bouncing off the walls, I'm all hyper, then that's a problem, so you can't use the glutamine. Arabinogalactans I use sometimes. I'll use things like NAC, N-acetylcysteine, which converts to glutathione, very potent antioxidant that supports. I'll use slippery elm. I'll use marshmallow, plantain, aloe vera, any of the demulcent type herbs, and we'll put together a protocol. Also with leaky gut, you want to look at the bacteria, so you want to make sure the fermented foods are a big piece of this, finding which ones they need, looking at their gut flora. You can either do a test or kind of play around with it and see how they react, but sometimes I'll look at their gut flora on a stool test, and I'll see that they're really great on their lactobacillus, but they're missing the bifidus, and they've been taking lactobacillus. So you got to cut them back on that and add the bifidus in. So there's a lot of pieces to it. We're going to be doing a whole course on digestive health.
I'm on Naturethroid. The doctor just upped my meds because my levels are FT3 6.1 and FT4 is 0.78. Wait,
FT3 is 6.1?
Yes.
So they dropped? That's way too high.
She can't lose weight, so he raised her meds. And her gut is sensing it's not her. She's sensing it's not her gut.
So, say those numbers again.
I will. FT3 is 6.1 and FT4 is 0.78.
She's hyper converting, or yes, because 0.7 is way too low on FT4. 6.2 is about, you know, almost double what it should be. So she should not have her meds raised.
She says weight, it's 3.0.
3.0? Okay, so, you know, she's not in the optimal range, but the 4, she's converting more. So has she looked at, she said she has Hashimoto's? Has she looked at antibodies? No, because, you know, this is a case where if they're going to increase anything, I would be giving her more T4. But her T3 is not too bad. Just be careful of not going too high on that and watch for symptoms because she can go into palpitations, et cetera. I would look at binding globulins.
She says
as well.
No.
She doesn't have Hashimoto's, or they haven't tested?
She says no.
Okay. Well, tell me if no means you haven't tested or they haven't. Because if you haven't tested, you got to test for the Hashimoto's. Yeah, and if you have a sense it's not your gut, I would want to know, are you on gluten? And, you know, have you been on gluten? Because even if you have a sense it's not your gut, if you've been on gluten and you haven't done a very comprehensive leaky gut repair protocol, you're in trouble. So I would look at antibodies for sure. Just run a TPO and an anti-thyroglobulin.
She says no tested to lose weight. Should she watch sugar?
Oh, absolutely. Everybody has to do insulin resistance protocol. Big, right, digestion. If you really have handled the digestion and it's not, next thing is blood sugar. I've seen people who's dropped their Hashimoto's antibodies dramatically because they did the leaky. That was the one thing they didn't do was the blood sugar. They do the blood sugar and boom, everything goes into place. Yeah, blood sugar imbalances. And then the adrenals, right? What's happening with your adrenal glands? Yeah.
Okay. Protocol for someone who has both A and C genes for MTHFR?
That's like way beyond the scope of this program because I can spend an hour talking that because there's no protocol for MTHFR because you've got to look at MTHFR. You've got to look at are they heterozygous or homozygous. You've got to also look at do they have the MTRRs and is that heterozygous or homozygous. You've got to look at COMT because if somebody has MTHFR, you can't give them too many methyl groups. You've got to really tone that down and go slowly because they'll back up in their methylation. This is, like I said, you may not even understand that. That may sound like gibberish to you. We have a whole module in the certification program that goes into that. We've already got about 12 hours recorded on that, plus all kinds of written stuff. There's no protocol for that. It's very individualized. There's no protocol for it. You can say put them on methyl B12 and try it. I mean methylfolate. You can try methylfolate, start at 150 micrograms, and then start working your way up. And if you start to see like weird psychological things or depression or anxiety happening, or headaches, you back off. Riboflavin is super important, so your B vitamins. Fresh whole foods, that's the safest way to get the folate up, is an abundance of leafy green vegetables, as much as your body will tolerate, the green juices, green smoothies, the greens, super important for that. With the methyl, with all the nutrigenomics, a lot of people want to know, here's my genes, what's the protocol? Foundations, foundations, foundations. So everybody's got to start with the really excellent diet, whatever, how many greens they can tolerate, making sure they're getting abundance of phytonutrients, and because that's where the methylfolate comes from. Foliage, that's where it comes from. So just looking at those genes. But yes, if you've got somebody who's on a standard American diet and they've got MTHFR, they're screwed, really, because they're not getting their methylated folate. Plus, if you add to that, they're taking a multivitamin from Walgreens, they're getting folic acid. So that would be the first starting point, too, is to check their diet, their supplements, and make sure there's no folic acid in the synthetic form, because that interrupts that and it makes it worse. So that's a starting point.
Are you familiar with the book Rethinking Fatigue by Nora Gedgandas?
I have heard of it. I haven't read it. What does it talk about?
She just wanted to know if you had an opinion.
I haven't read it, so I'm sorry I haven't. There's so many books out there that are on my shelf that I haven't finished reading yet.
And Marie would have the question before about where we're trying to figure out if it was Hashimoto's.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
She said thank you because her digestion is not good.
Okay, there you go.
If TSH is 5.04, FT3 is 2.4, and FT4 is in ideal range, can it be a conversion problem, or is it more likely primary hypothyroid? Gut dysbiosis is a known issue in this case.
Yeah, so with the free T3 that low and the free T4 in the ideal range, there definitely is a conversion component to it. And like everything else, it's usually multifactorial. So there's definitely a conversion component to it. With that free, with the TSH so high, I would want to see what her total T3 is and see if there's maybe a binding globulin issue as well. But because the feedback mechanism is, wow, the T3 or the T4 is low. So it can be, and it usually is. I would be looking at iodine status for sure. And did she say she has antibodies?
Nope, she doesn't say.
Okay, and antibodies. If you're working with somebody or you're working with yourself and you haven't tested thyroid antibodies, whether you have a known thyroid problem or not, that's one of the very first things. Part of my basic protocol for doing lab testing for people, vitamin D, you know, the complete blood, and antibodies. That's primary.
No antibodies. Total T3 is 85.
Total T3 is 85. Yeah, so I would say there's probably both a conversion issue and a primary hypothyroid. So if she went to the doctor, she'd have a prescription for Synthroid, which wouldn't help the conversion issue. She may get a prescription for Naturethroid, which could be helpful as well. But again, that means you're giving it, and it's a great stopgap measure, but you've got to make sure your body is able to convert on its own without having to give it outside. So the selenium, the zinc, and all the things we talked about yesterday. And today we're going to talk about protocols for these things. So I have a slide for each of these protocols, and I have a sheet that you can go through and figure it out.
What about very high sex-binding globulin at 148, nearly twice as much as maximum of normal range.
Yeah. High SBG is sex hormone, SHBG is a common cause of hypothyroid because it interferes with the conversion and it will interfere with the synthesis of thyroid hormone. A lot of causes for that you need to look into, and again, that could be an hour-long discussion about that. Yeah, but.
And Mia, who had talked about the book, said Sean Croxton interviewed her in the digestion sessions. She said the hippocampus is vulnerable to elevated cortisol levels, which lead to cortisol rhythm dysregulation.
Absolutely. The hippocampus gets destroyed. I mean, it actually gets tissue destruction from cortisol levels. And that will affect just about everything, the thermoregulation, memory, short-term memory. You know, you walk into the room and where are my keys? I don't know why I walked in the room. That's very common in certainly stage one adrenal fatigue, but stage three adrenal fatigue as well, because you've been through stage one to get to stage three. Hippocampus destruction is common. One of the things that calms that down and actually has been shown to repair is phosphatidylserine. But the studies have shown that phosphatidylserine has to be in the neighborhood of 800 milligrams a day, which could be really costly. And most people don't want to do it, but you can also apply a phosphatidylserine cream, and that will help to get it in, and phosphatidylserine will repair the hippocampus.
And this same author recommends a ketogenic diet and to work with a practitioner who studied under Dr. Karazian.
Well, I've studied under Dr. Karazian. I have took one of his very first classes. I actually was the one that really enforced with him that he should be telling everybody to go gluten-free when I took one of his first classes. And he was like, yeah, it's kind of important. I said, if somebody has thyroid antibodies, they should be. I went back a couple of years later and took his thyroid class, and he was like, adamant Nazi about gluten-free. Says, if somebody won't go gluten-free, I won't work with them. So yes, I'm familiar with Dr. Karazian. I recommend his protocols. I incorporate it with some other things. And what was the other question about that you should? Oh yeah. So a ketogenic diet can be very helpful. You also have to be careful with a ketogenic diet or something close to a ketogenic diet, which is more what I would recommend is a modified ketogenic diet. Because a ketogenic diet, to be truly ketogenic, you can't even eat many vegetables. Because I did a test. I thought I was eating a ketogenic diet when I was eating, if I eat a lot of nuts and a lot of veggies, no fruit, no grains, no nothing. And just my veggies alone got me up to 150 milligrams of carbohydrate a day, which is out of the ketogenic range. You have to be under 50 to get into that ketogenic range for most people. And it's awesome for seizures, and it's awesome as a therapeutic regime. I don't know that ketogenic diet is a good long-term, but it can be very helpful, especially if you're not doing a ketogenic diet where you're loading up on meat. You can do there's a thing called the coconut ketogenic diet where you're using a lot of coconut oil, which is really supportive of the immune system and the gut.
With someone who has SIBO, is fiber the main culprit? SIBO.
Yeah, I don't know that fiber is the main culprit. I don't think fiber causes health problems. I think it's dysregulation from crap before that, from eating a lot of sugar, which throws off the gut, from eating the refined carbs, from eating a standard American diet your whole life, which most of us have done, and the fiber then aggravates it. And sometimes you have to cut back on some of the fiber to help with the SIBO. And you can't be taking high-dose probiotics. You have to be careful of what strains, and that's where doing a stool analysis to see what's really living in your gut makes a huge difference.
Would a ketogenic diet work well for SIBO?
It certainly could work for SIBO, yeah. Uh-huh.
How do you deal with doctors who say not to use any herbs or holistic services?
I say find a new doctor.
Would you recommend testing for SIBO with known digestive problems and gut dysbiosis?
Sure, you can do the breath test to test for SIBO, yeah. But I would do all the other stuff first because usually it clears up when you do and the SIBO is not really as common as they think.
That's it.
Yeah. Is that it?
Yep.
You guys are awesome. These are great questions. And hearing these questions says you want to go deeper. And we have a limited time here in 3 days even. It's like, oh my God, I can't teach everything I know in 3 days. I can't even teach everything I know in 3 years. But we try to do it in 2 years in the nutritional endocrinology practitioner training, and I would highly recommend that you look seriously at joining us. We have some awesome people. The first two people to sign up here are medical doctors. We also have another medical doctor also in the program. We have a bunch of nurses. I mean, we're really, my goal is to make nutritional endocrinology a household word and to really infiltrate the medical system with this concept and to help you to go deep with all this stuff and not look for a protocol. We are not here to look for protocols. We're looking at understanding the underlying biochemistry, physiology, anatomy, and pathophysiology, and the person's psychology, incorporating all that into a personalized nutrition program for a person.
I have two more questions.
Sure.
What tests for SIBO? And then the other question is, can you recommend a soil-based organism supplement to help rebuild gut flora?
Okay, two answers. One, the most recognized test for SIBO, the most accurate, would be the hydrogen breath test. And the other one is soil-based organisms. I don't really use much in the way of soil-based organisms. I look at the person. I look at their gut flora. I create a program, and I like to get them to do fermented foods. And what Steph talked about the other day, and we're going to have her on my show soon so you can get into, she's an expert on fermentation and the different strains of bacteria and helping you to really create fermented foods that's customized to what that person needs in terms of their flora, which is, I think is an awesome concept, and it's not talked about in any place else that I know of. Okay. Yeah?
That's done.
You guys are awesome. I'm just so thrilled that you've been spending your weekend with us here. Do we have any questions from the peanut gallery here? We'll get to you later. I think we have to start. So we'll get started, and then we'll answer your questions. So thank you so much, and we'll see you in a few minutes. What's that?